I'm Kai Wright, and this is Midday on WNYC. It's a truism at this point to say Donald Trump's first year in office has been tumultuous. But what has that tumult meant for the Republican Party in particular? How have the old power brokers of the party adapted to the president's leadership, and who is in control of the party now? Documentary filmmaker Michael Kirk explores these questions in a pair of PBS Frontline specials. His film, Trump's Takeover, airs tonight on public television stations around the country. Then next Tuesday, his film, McCain, follows. Michael Kirk joins us today to discuss both films. Michael, welcome.
Hi, Kai.
So let's start with the film that airs tonight, Trump's Takeover. It's really a history of his first year in his presidency as seen through the vantage of the Republican Party's leadership, or at least its old leadership. Why is that an interesting vantage point to view this first year to you?
Well, if you can stay at 20,000 feet and ignore the shiny baubles that land on the table hourly in watching the Trump administration, it seems to me there's a value in understanding how he came to Washington, what he came to operate as, what the party itself, who in no way expected him to win, what their response was, and how how what he did to win them over or bludgeon them into submission, what that actually tells us about what's going to happen going forward.
In the film, Roger Stone describes Trump's win as a, quote, hostile takeover of the Republican Party. How was it a takeover, I guess, in that bludgeoning or a hostile one? Is that the point with this bludgeoning that you're describing?
I find myself whenever I'm talking about Donald Trump accidentally or maybe unconsciously using war descriptions all the time. It is for those of us who've covered presidents going back way too far, it is a stunning reality of covering this particular president and this particular Republican unified Congress. That it does feel a little bit like we visit the battlefield every time we go in and do a round of interviews or try to make connections in an editing room from one dot to another about things that happened over a year. I mean, it was, I think the film tells the story, a kind of shocking and revealing story, at least to me, of the difference between what Republicans said in July of 2016, when Trump came to town for a victory lap as the presumptive nominee, to their language and their aspect and everything that they were giving off on December 20th of 2017, when they were glorying in the success of the massive tax cut. The words that were said at the end and the words that were said at the beginning are the brackets for the and the basis for this film.
So let's walk through a little bit of that history. You know, we watch in the film, and it's fascinating to the sort of old power brokers as they try to sort of figure out how to capitalize on this takeover, on Trump's takeover of the party. And Paul Ryan, in particular, is at first optimistic. Is that how you would describe him at the outset? Is he just sort of, he thinks, you know, here's a guy who wants to win, and I can deliver those victories?
I think that's apt. I think that's exactly right. Remember that both, I've talked to people who watched the election with McConnell, Speaker of the House McConnell, Leader of the Senate McConnell and Speaker of the House Ryan, watched the election night returns. And they were both, according to people we talked to who were with them, they were both perfectly prepared to work with Hillary Clinton. They thought, all right, you know, it's going to be, we're going to have the House and Senate. She's going to have the White House. We're going to work this out because she knows how to do it. She's
We know her. We know where she comes from. We know where we're going to do it.
Yeah, we know we speak the same language. When Trump wins, there's a big gulp there, knowing that it will fall first to Ryan. We then spend a lot of time in the film with Ryan and his strategy. And his strategy was, as you suggest, wins. This is what this guy wants. He just wants to win. He's going to be the pen. We're the we're unified government. Even Ryan stands up and gives a speech and says, oh, are we excited about this? And I think in some way he was excited, despite the fact fact that he had said some pretty nasty things about about Trump, especially after the Access Hollywood moment, or whatever you want to call it. Here's Ryan who's thinking, well, it's politics. We're all, he's not going to carry a grudge. I'm going to deliver what he needs. And the first thing I'm going to deliver is the thing everybody expects us to deliver, which is repeal and replace of Obamacare. For 7.5 years, we've been arguing about this. The Res Republicans have been saying, we've got to do this. Trump made the promise. I'll make this easy for him. I'll invent a plan. We'll come in there and we'll get it done. And as Corey Lewandowski in the film says, easy, squeezy, lemon peasy, we'll pull it off.
And it's not just what he thinks Trump needs, but it's what he wants. He can march through a long list of Republican dreams with this guy who presumably just wants to sign stuff and call it a victory. And you spend a lot of time on the Affordable Care Act in the film and that fight. And it's sort of at the outset of it's where Paul Ryan learns pretty quickly that he's in a different place than he thought he was with Trump. What do you think he learns?
I think he learns the following things. Well, first he learns something about his own party, which is that they're really good at playing defense, but they're not very good at playing offense. I had a lot of members of Congress tell me that when it came time to actually write legislation that was, here's what we're going to do, not what we want to stop people from doing, they didn't know how to do it. Tom Cole, one of the congressmen, said to me, we had no idea what to do. So, and they had no idea that the Freedom Caucus was going to push back really hard on whatever Ryan wrote and want to test Trump and see whether they could roll him. So from the very beginning, Ryan learned something about his own party, which is that there's a great fracture down the middle there, an ideological and doctrinaire fracture. Second, he learns about Trump. He's not the salesman that he thought he would, that he thought Trump would be, and I think that Trump thought he would be. He knows nothing about the details, does none of the homework, isn't really interested in it. We heard stories of Ryan trying to deliver a PowerPoint presentation to the president, who held his hands up after about a minute and a half or 2 minutes. There's some argument about whether it was longer than 2 minutes, but not very much longer. Mm-hmm. And just says, tell me what you want to do. Go ahead and do it, and I'll help you. He wants to spread the power of the presidency around with Republicans. There's the rides on Air Force One. There's the meetings at the White House. There's the barbecue. There's bowling. There's all these things he does, but none of them really have anything to do with the substance of the argument between the Freedom Caucus and other members of the Republican Caucus, and certainly than what Ryan is up against over there. Trump is looking at his watch continuously and is incredibly impatient. And somebody in the film says to us something that just rang absolutely positively clear, which is Trump, who thinks of himself as the art of the deal guy, as a salesman, is used to real estate deals and other kinds of deals where everybody, the only skin everybody has in the game is money. But when you get into arguing with people who are doctrinaire, who are ideological, Trump isn't doctrinaire, and he's not ideological, and he didn't understand the policy, and so the things that had helped him get casinos built and other things didn't really work for him with members of the Freedom Caucus. He tried an ultimatum. It didn't work. They had to pull the bill, and in the end, it had to be behind closed doors with Ryan arguing strongly with them.
And there's an interesting, deeper point here, too. What Trump's presidency in this sense shows us, is Washington is not, in fact, a town of just craven dealmakers, that it is a place full of people with ideas and deeply held ideologies that you have to be able to figure out how to work with.
Well, exactly, and when you think about the legislative side of Trump's, welcome to Washington, Donald Trump experience, I don't know that he actually. We talked to a lot of people: Lewandowski, Kellyanne Conway, Spicer, and many others about what did he know? And they will all say it wasn't about legislation for him. It wasn't about policy. He had Eric Cantor says in the film. He came to Washington to grab it by the lapels and shake it into a submission. And you know, that's not the way the legislative process works. And I think he learned that the hard way. Through the replace and repeal of Obamacare, the tools he brought to the game, the legislative side of the game, were not his great strength. And when John McCain puts the thumbs down at 1:30 in the morning, in lots of ways getting even for many clashes with Trump, I think Trump realized, oh, this isn't the side of the table that I should be playing on.
I'm speaking with Michael Kirk about his two new Frontline documentaries, Trump's Takeover, which airs tonight on PBS, and McCain, which will follow next Tuesday night. Speaking of this fight for the ACA and sort of marching through the details of when the big moments that matter in it, you zero in on a scene where the president holds a celebration of the House finally passing the bill. Ryan finally, you know, it goes down in flames the first time, but Ryan finally gets his troops together. He gets a bill through the House, and there's a Rose Garden celebration. Can you describe that scene and what it means to people that you spoke to?
Yes, it's an astonishing moment in the early going of Donald Trump's presidency that probably won't be forgotten simply because of the absurdity of it, if nothing else. He's been very unhappy with the amount of time it's taken just to get this bill passed. Doesn't really, as I've said, know any of the details, but it does get passed by the House. There's a compromise between the Freedom Caucus and Paul Ryan. And so it gets passed. Nobody believes it's going to pass the Senate. They all know this is just, you know, we'll move it on to the Senate. Maybe the Senate will write a bill that everybody can salute. But this isn't one of them. We're just moving it along the line. But Trump has wanted a victory so badly that he sends buses up to the Congress and brings all the Republicans down to a garden party in the Rose Garden at the White House. There's a string quartet. They're all lined up there for the photographs. Many of them, you know, bemused, to say the least. Most of the press that's there, their jaws are just dropping because they realize what Congressman Tom Cole told us, which is this is like spiking the football at the 50-yard line. This is proof to them that Trump doesn't really understand the process at all. This is not a moment of celebration. This is absurd.
And not only not a moment of celebration, is making it harder. It's actively undermining the effort to achieve something that was already going to be a long shot.
Well, exactly. And when you watch this section of the film and you see him say, hey, this is great, isn't it? Believe it or not, I'm president of the United States. It's just one of those things that from our editing room to your living room, we just all sat there and thought, wow, we're not in Kansas anymore at a moment like that in the early going, at least, with this president who's thrilled. That's something that, you know, it doesn't really deserve the word thrilled attached to it. And of course, what happens just right after that is that in town halls all over America, people feeling threatened with their health care, who've come, I guess, over the 7 years to embrace an awful lot of the Affordable Care Act, are at town meetings, and it's very reminiscent of the 2009 town meetings that were the sort of genesis moment for the growth of the Tea Party. And now it's happening, on cable television right in front
just
of the president.
Raw rage.
Suddenly
just
he realizes, holy smoke, right?
Yeah, just raw rage that all of these Republican representatives and senators are asked to face when they go home.
Exactly.
And so it plays out in front of, as you say, on cable news. The president watches it. He reacts. What is his reaction? And importantly, what did the party learn from his reaction?
Well, he goes to the Senate then and has another one of his famous get-togethers with them, and he says the bill is mean. That I hope he'll do better than the House did. The House bill was mean, driving all the members of the House who took a hard vote in lots of cases crazy and saying, hey, wait, this guy's not with us, and sending a signal to the senators, the Republican senators, hey, this guy's not going to be with us either, whatever we do. And really, in lots of ways, for Ryan, for McConnell, for others, this is a very scary moment to realize that the extent to which the president doesn't know what is actually happening and is so malleable in the sense of throwing a garden party, then seeing what the response is to the bill, then saying to the next people who have to deal with it, this is a mean bill, really sent everybody running for cover.
Well, I mean, malleable is a generous way to put it. You know, I mean, it's also sort of in the world of politics and in Washington, it's open betrayal of the House members who had taken that hard vote.
But certainly many of them felt that and said that.
Yeah. And, Washington works on trust. So how, at this point, I'm wondering, what are they thinking? How are some of these GOP leaders who have gone in on this, thinking when it's clear that the leader, they cannot trust the leader to stand up for them if they walk the plank on a vote?
Well, we talked to Jeff Flake at some length, who eventually will quit the Senate or not run for re-election at the hands of maybe his own actions, but also certainly direct action by Donald Trump, which comes a little later in our story. But Flake said at the time when he heard the mean and he watched the ceremony and the garden party, he said this is in the garden. He said this president on the one level is betraying the House, on the other level is sending a frightening signal to the rest of us that he doesn't really know and he might not be there for us. And I think that was fairly typical of the way a lot of people thought about it, and they generate what's called the skinny replace and repeal bill, mm-hmm. simply, I think, primarily to get something out there, because Trump is knocking on the door all the time, basically saying, where is it, where is it, where is it, I need a win. Remember, the press, by now certainly no friend of Donald Trump or the White House, is the clock is ticking for the press corps too, and they're regularly saying 100 days, 200 days, what's coming out of here. No major piece of legislation has been yielded by or driven by Donald Trump. What's going on? Is this the biggest failure ever? And he doesn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Michael Kirk about his two new frontline documentaries, Trump's Takeover and McCain, which take us inside President Trump's high-stakes battle for control of the GOP throughout his first year in office. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC, and I am back with Michael Kirk talking about his new films on both the Trump takeover of the Republican Party and John McCain's biography, airing first tonight on PBS and then next Tuesday on PBS. And Michael, so Senator Jeff Flake, we started talking about him before the break. He plays a huge role in the film and, of course, a huge role in the history of this administration so far. What's he represent in this story? Why is he so off-put? Why is Trump so off-putting to him?
Well, Flake, to be, let's keep the record straight. Flake has voted, I think, 90%, maybe more than that, for Trump, I guess, Trump proposals. It's
right.
Funny to call them Trump proposals, but because he's in some ways they're Ryan or McConnell proposals. But
despite all the rhetoric, all the speeches, he is, in fact, from a policy perspective, 98%. Vote for
exactly with Trump. So what is his objection, and who is he? So he's the guy sitting in Barry Goldwater's seat. He came as a congressman, very conservative when he came in 2000. Mike Pence's best friend at the time. I think they no longer speak. An establishment, a small government kind of Republican, conservative Republican, who's now called an establishment Republican. Right. That's a dirty word in Washington.
And he rose to power as an insurgent from the right, like in a very similar dynamic.
Exactly. He and Pence used to be called Butch and Sundance at the in the Congress once upon a time for running in and stopping, votes getting sleezed in and stuff like that. They're a legendary kind of guy. when Trump, you know, comes to Washington that summer, he takes objection to he has really not liked the way Trump handled the birther thing. He thought it was just unseemly. It does not like absolutely is angry about what Trump said about John McCain, Flake's mentor and Arizona senior senator. He's just a guy who, and he doesn't take any guff off of anybody, and is kind of proud to take to become the loyal opposition to Trump, not knowing, I think, what the implications of that were actually going to be. In the first instance, not believing that Trump was going to win. In the second instance, believing that Trump would pivot like anybody expected him to do. And when Trump doesn't do that, Flake is constantly arguing not about the substance of Republican policy. But remember, Trump isn't entirely interested in the policy, but about the actions of the president, the unseemly quality, what Flake calls the lies, the obfuscations, the crassness of it, all of it like that. And he is regularly standing up. He writes a book in secret. Even his staff doesn't know about it over the summer and it is released around the time of all of the fights where Trump is pushing back on the Senate after the replace and repeal bill dies because of McCain's vote. So Flake is the what he thinks of as the loyal opposition in a kind of formal sense to Trump inside the party. He's hoping that he has fellow travelers, Corker and others, who will stick with him in this battle. But it's anybody's guess, watching the summer, really August of 2017, unfold about what will actually eventuate for Flake. And that's the second half of our film from Charlottesville on, about what happens to Flake and what happens with Trump through the Charlottesville moment and the rest of the Senate.
We're going to talk about that. But first, just what do you think? I'm trying to wrap my head around Jeff Flake in this sense, right? Like, because again, from a policy perspective, he's not offended by the policy ideas, but you say he is singularly offended by this, just by the man, by who Trump is. Why? What is it about Jeff Flake? What is it that makes this so off-putting to him? While most of the rest of the party, certainly people with his leadership level, even John McCain, aren't speaking as loudly and as explicitly as Flake is throughout that period.
Well, so I ask lots of people this very question, Kai, and many of them point to his faith. He's a Mormon, very straight arrow kind of a guy, at least in his religious beliefs and in his life, as far as anybody knows. So there is a lot about the way the president just plain acts that he thinks is horrible and deplorable. And obviously, we'll get to Charlottesville, but when Charlottesville happens, that's it for Flake. He really believes that stain of a president, a Republican president, saying and acting that way, literally splashes onto the Republican Party and stains the party irretrievably in so many ways. And that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about conservative political issues. He's talking about the realm that is really Trump's power realm, which is the cultural side of the way Trump acts.
Well, so Charlottesville, and you do walk viewers through a chilling recounting of the president's sort of day, hour by hour reaction to what happened in Charlottesville. I think what is striking about it, well, there are many things that are striking about it, but in the film, on this subject of Republicans, it is the first time following that, there's the first time where you see really massive, widespread, explicit denunciation of the president from the Republican leadership, right? I mean,
it's the low ebb moment for Donald Trump, you would think. This is the moment where he's 35 members of his party have tweeted. Ryan McConnell, all of them have said this is abhorrent. They've made statements. McConnell makes a statement about it. It's really, and McConnell is not a guy who, goes public with things very often. It is, you would imagine that in the hands of almost any president, this moment would have been devastating and whatever. But, you know, we remember, I remember back to a biography we made during called The Choice during the fall when he was running against Hillary Clinton, the sort of woven biographies. And I remember a section, a lot of research we did into Roy Cohn and the impact of Cohn and his philosophy about how to attack and counterpunch during moments like this and declare victory and all of the things. And I think that press conference in our film for an hour or so in Trump Tower, after they told the press that they were not going to take any questions, and Trump just decides to let it fly, and it just feels like a page right out of Cohen. This is, you know, counterattack, never admit failure, never back up, go for it completely. And that, frankly, from a lot of the people we talked to, Republicans we talked to, that scared them. They thought, wow, we're really in another place here now.
Scared them and cowed them, would you say, also?
I don't know. You see, this is a really good question, Kai. This is something that, you know, when you're sitting there trying to tell this story, you have to say, am I going to make a judgment about this, or am I going to let it be there and think about it and hope the viewer will think about it and talk about it too? And this is that question of, is it a demonstration project that Trump does a lot of when he beats up Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate, in tweet after tweet after the failure of the skinny repeal bill, castigating him, humiliating him, having a screaming, profanity-laced conversation with him on the phone from Bedminster, his country club in New Jersey. I, you know, as Frank Luntz says in the film, why would you do that? What would tell you that this is the guy who has to do things for you to get a legislation passed? And, you know, some part of me says, and certainly what a lot of Republicans have told me, is they think of it as demonstration projects like firing Bannon and all of those big kind of thermonuclear interpersonal moments are sending a message that this is a guy who's going to brook no, give nobody any quarter if they decide to go against him. And I think in some ways, Flake, from that very first lunch back in July of 2016, Flake had a target painted on him. And it seems like when Flake is one of the people that write a tweet, and he said to us, you know, this is a layup. A president of the United States at a moment like this just says, let's all heal, let's all get together. Of course we don't like, you know, white supremacists here. When Trump said that, I mean, when Flake said that, it just feels like when you look at what happens next, you say, this is a guy who has if he doesn't have a plan, he has an automatic response, going back to the Roy Cohn playbook, which is, we'll counterattack.
I will hit you harder. I mean, there's this great moment in the film, a little later in the film, where Corey Lewandowski, you know, and it's you can feel it through the screen, where he's just gleefully, viciously almost declaring victory over Flake, where he's saying, yeah, well, you know what? All this time later, Flake is a guy who used to be a senator, that he has, been crushed. Do you think that is the message that the Republicans have gotten?
Well, something in that period, see, Trump, 1 week after the Charlottesville tweets and all of it, he jumps a plane. He flies in the presidential Air Force One to Arizona, the home state of Flake and McCain. McCain, who voted no on the repeal, Flake, who's been saying what Flake's been saying, and he holds a rally attended by 10 or 20,000 people, and it's very much right in the heart of Flake's base. Flake is running for re-election, and he wants to, the president wants to send a message, which is, these are my people. First and foremost, I know they're your constituents, but you're heading into a primary, and I can primary you here. You need these people, and you will never win once I've come here and said what I'm about to say. And he does this speech, which is in the film tonight, it just, you know, that says, I've been asked not to name any names. Well, I won't name any names, but I'll tell you this. And he just ravages Flake and McCain at this event. And when I talked to Flake about it, he said, you know, look, there's no way. He said, I might even win a general election if I could get to one. Arizona is trending more in the Democratic direction than it has been. But he said, I'm never going to get out of the primary. Yeah. I had about 8% of those things. He sent that message. Well, that was a message, Kai, that I think he sent to more than just Flake. I think that message from that event and many other things that were done was a direct line to anybody who's worried about being primaried, anybody who might have trouble, anybody who might go against the President of the United States. And in fact, 3 dozen or so people have said they're not going to stick around. And it's right after he returns from Arizona that he gets into the tweet storm with Bob Corker, where Corker says, Senator Corker says, the line about adult daycare at the White House.
Very, very quickly, Michael, because we have less than a minute, in 30 seconds, the McCain film. And the interesting thesis here is that a lot of this started with John McCain's campaign.
John McCain equals whatever has happened with the Republican Party and the change that's occurred over the last 3 decades. The most important legacy, people in the film would argue, from John McCain, given everything he's done, is, and you're there for all of it in this film, is the delivery of Sarah Palin to the base.
I've got to leave you there. I'm sorry. I've been speaking with Michael Kirk about his two new Frontline documentaries, Trump's Takeover, which premieres tonight at 10 p.m., and McCain, which premieres on April 17th on WNET Channel 13. Thank you so much for joining me, Michael. Sorry to cut you off.
You bet, Kai. That's okay.